Hello, welcome everyone. Welcome to session 9 of our Ontology Summit. This is again the Ontology Summit 2012 is entitled Ontology for Big Systems. My name is Steve Ray. And this session on the 8th of March is on track 4, which is on large-scale domain applications. And we have a very full agenda today. We have actually 5 speakers, so we're going to have to be good about keeping to the time schedule. This session has got a collection of large-scale applications in both the biomedical, the earth, environmental science, and traditional engineering, in this case oil drilling engineering applications. So what I will ask the speakers to do is try to be observant of our 10-minute goal per speech, per presentation. I know that's going to be hard. All of you have a lot of slides, but failing that, we're going to have little time for discussion. So I will try and give you a one-minute warning when you're at 9 minutes so that you have a chance to sort of wrap things up. So again, let's see if you can bring up, you have them on the VNC, but I'm now speaking, I'll speak to slide number 2 in the introductory slides. And basically, the point of track 4, this large systems, large scale domain applications is to, rather than talking about the issues, we're trying to ground the discussions of the issues by bringing to light and presenting some real applications, and those applications might be large in the sense of complexity, and I think this first one you'll hear today is that example, and many of the others are large in the sense of big data, huge, you know, 100 billion plus pieces of data sometimes, trying to manage that, and of course some of these systems are combinations of both. So but the point of this track is, again, to keep these examples in mind as potential use cases to hold up to some of these issues we've been discussing in the other tracks. So this is sort of keeps us real, keeps us grounded. So slide number 3 on the intro slides, there's a thumbnail cheat sheet on the topic, the domains, if you like, of the 5 talks we'll be hearing today. And the first one is oil exploration, if you like, or oil drilling. Not so much exploration, I believe. But if you go to slide 4, you actually see who's doing the presenting. And David Price from Top Quadrant will be talking about a sort of a classic complex system. And many of the others, I've gone through all the slides myself, have to deal with large manipulations of data, trying to, of course, synthesize different data stores of this large amount of data. So I'm not going to take any more time here because we are so tight. And again, to all the speakers, our goal is 10 minutes, so I'll be reminding you at the end of that or near the end of that. And the rest of the audience, can go ahead and they can load up the first slide from David Price. Top Quadrant, and David, I'll let you go ahead and take the floor, and I'll start timing.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, so I'm going to report about a project that's going on to use semantic web technologies and ontologies in the oil and gas industry. Going on to slide 2, I thought the first set of slides, which are I'll go through quite quickly, are slides that the customer has created to explain to others what the project is about, and that's just more background, so I'll go through those quite quickly. And then the second set of the presentation is about our experiences, and that's the part that's probably more interesting to this community. So moving on to slide 3, the project is the customer is called EPAM, the Exploration and Production Information Management Association. Going on to slide 4, the idea is that this consortium produces software platforms that are used by numerous operators out in the Norwegian continental shelf and elsewhere. So the customer is a consortium and the users are the actual operators out in the North Sea and the partners in those oil platforms. Going on to slide five, the main objective is actually to take, it's actually both drilling reports, daily drilling reports right off the platform of what happened during the course of the day, and two kinds of reports from the platforms and other locations like terminals and subsea and other places like that of production, actually oil after the drilling is completed and it's in production, daily production reports and monthly production reports. And then the data is integrated into a central repository. That's the triple store, the ontology. The data comes in as XML files. We transform it and then generate reports and queries over the triple store, and the reports go to the Norwegian government agencies and to the partners in the platforms and licenses out there in the sea. Going on to slide six, just a little picture of what happens. An XML file comes in, it's validated. There's a department, a Norwegian authority called the Norwegian Petroleum Authority that produces what they call the fact pages. And that's the basic information about each well and each field and each terminal out in the sea. And so based on that, we're able to generate what wells are located in what places in the sea, who owns them, who are partners in them, who's operating them, and things like that. And we can validate the reports coming in because the reports are all about a well or a field or something like that that's in the facts. So you can think of the NPD facts as linked data. It's actually produced as we harvest CSV files and turn them into ontology and into the ontology and individuals based on that ontology, and then we link up the report data coming in to those facts. And that happens by finding, first validating that the data conforms to the facts, then it's XML schema valid and things like that. And then we have a set of transformations that we generate the triples from that goes into the repository. And then we have a set of transformations that produce reports, HTML in this example, and PDF using a technology called Sparkle Web Pages that actually does embed Sparkle inside of HTML pages. And we actually store both the submitted XML files and the triples, and the users can then, in addition to the reports being automatically transferred to the authorities, the users can actually log in and download these reports, and over time they'll be able to do queries over the, and aggregations and things like that over the triple store itself. Right now it's pre-built reports. On slide seven, I just included this to show an example of what the EPM, the customer, tells their customers, the operators, about why they went this way with semantic web technologies. This is nothing that's of news to anybody here, but this is the kind of sort of what the semantic web is about to them on one slide and why it's interesting to them, because the real world's complex and changing, and it's a good technology for dealing with scenarios that are complex and change over time. So summing up from the customer's point of view, the technology ontologies can handle complexity and change quite easily. The reports can be updated. Data can be added to the triple stores, partitioned, secured through access control mechanisms. Over time, we'll be able to do reasoning, such in addition to validation of the data, and we're building it on top of a solid foundation. The foundation is actually based in, but is not exactly, the ISO 15926 four-dimensionalist ontology that has been talked about by others as part of this summit. And slide nine is that this actually a first step. We're doing daily drilling reports, monthly production reports, and daily production reports, but over time there's all sorts of other information that might get added to this reporting hub application, so there's lots of scope for growth and added complexity over time. Now switching to the part that's probably more interesting to the audience here is what the technology is about. The scale, it's a software as a service, so the idea is that it'll be delivered. There'll be about 3 million triples in the next 4 years, and obviously the potential for much more if additional data sources are added or historical data is brought in. 40 users at a time, concurrent. They also have REST and SOAP services. The source is a set of XML schemas that we've gone through. There's about 2,000-ish elements that result in about 900-ish classes and 900-ish properties in the ontology that's the core of the project. And like I said, it's delivered as a software as a service, high availability. So we've gone with quite a powerful RDF database that has warm callover and replication and secondary servers that run at all times, keep the databases lined up. And if the core server fails, primary service fails, we can switch over quite quickly to the secondary. So it is a hardcore real application. Our viewpoint, technology-wise, this project and most of ours is ontologies are software artifacts. They're part of an application. That application has a purpose. The purpose is not always to represent the real world and not always to enable reasoners. So the ontologies don't necessarily always represent the real world and they're not always amenable to reasoning. Creating ontologies and using them has its challenges, but it's not a lot harder than other software engineering tests. In fact, in this project, the semantic tasks have gone more quickly and easily than the other tasks about getting servers built, developing SOAP web services, and getting Java to talk to Microsoft, things like that. The application of these ontologies often have quite competing and conflicting requirements, and trade-offs are necessary. So in this case, the ontology is supposed to support change and aggregation using four-dimensionalism. They also want to support reasoning, you know, most of that's description logic reasoning. It also needs to be understandable by software engineers and have good query performance so that the reports that get generated on the fly come back to actual users and sitting in front of a browser get reasonable performance, and the answer is it's very difficult to do that. Slide 12, the use of ontologies in top quadrant. We use ontologies for everything, and I mean literally everything. We have the domain ontologies that are cover the scope of the oil and gas, but we use proxy ontologies for XML schemas, so we automatically generate an ontology directly from an XML schema, and then when we import XML files, we can treat them as triples and sparkle over them as the XML data. We also do the same thing for CSV files. Sparkle, we have an ontology of the Sparkle language so that we can connect up these things as triples, the queries, and store them and manage them as data in the repository. We have a whole library of functions, and we can generate REST services to expose the data to other kinds of technologies like JSON, et cetera. The use of Sparkle and Spin, it's critical technologies for us. Ontologies on their own do very little for an application. Spin is what we're using to do all the transformations and validations. So we actually treat XML files coming in as triples and convert those into triples based on a 4D ontology using Sparkle. And Spin lets us do that slightly easier. And we also use Sparkle web pages where we embed Sparkle into HTML, and that's how we generate reports and web pages. The challenges from the ontology team, if you have a group of ontologists working together, everyone's got their own flavor of ontology they like. They always think that what they like can be better. And often can't believe other people don't just love the way they do ontologies. If you love description logic, then you know you love description logic. First order is an issue, undecidability, all these things come into play. And in the end, what often happens is because you get different views and different ways of doing ontology development, somebody at the end has to integrate them all and align them. And that's been the case, and that's been part of my job, actually. And also, turning engineers into ontologists, they don't often have the skills, and early mistakes become legacy that have to be worked around. We've had a little bit of that because of some background ontologies and data and reference data we're supposed to be using in this project. And it's not as much within the team, but these issues have popped up with people who the team interacts with, who are a part of the customer base, for example, and the audience. Slide 15, the cost. Large-scale ontology is expensive. It also suffers from engineering, the at some point you just stop syndrome. So reusing large ontologies other people have done is often hard work because they're not complete, they're not completely documented because the money ran out, and we've run into that a little bit as well. As far as ontology software, there is a little bit of an issue with software people, Java developers, and ontologists. The software developers can prove their code work. We can't prove our ontologies work. It's hard to test an ontology. The Java guys and the XML schema modelers don't really care about ontological purity. And in the end, the software development team owns the application, not the ontologist, so they're the ones who deploy things. And if it comes down to can we make something work or not, in the end, in a lot of cases, they get to make the final decision. 17, practicalities. The infrastructure supports software development quite well, but it doesn't support ontology development quite well. For example, software people can use Git in different kinds of version control, and the diff utility is worthwhile to merge data back together or files and changes over time, but those utilities just don't work for ontologies. Turtle files are the example that we're using. And I mentioned this last issue on the Exploder is you can't sparkle over non-human readable things as far as URIs and names and concepts. The idea that you can use the label, the RDF label, just doesn't work. So we've had to force human readable, understandable URIs into the picture. And the documentation of the ontologies often varies. Slide 18, the last one. In summary, the semantics of an XML schema and data coming in from these complex industries is not a quick process. It's taken time. We're using Franz as a Allegro graph for this project. And so one bit of goodness is that there are real scalable enterprise stores now that support ACID, commit, rollback, warm, standby, backup and recovery, replication, and all things you expect out of a proper database. Spin and Sparkle are really great for doing the transformations. That's worked really, really well, and they make the mappings visible to non-programmers. So somebody who understands Sparkle can understand the relationship between the data coming in and the data going out. And Spin and Sparkle, by constructing data, is also how we're going to turn the data that we've got in the core ontologies into DL-safe ontologies for a full 1596 and other uses. So that's a little bit over my time, I think, but I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, David, for rushing through that just a little bit so that we could fit in the time. And there are a few questions on the chat, David, if you wanted to perhaps answer those on the chat, because we're going to reserve most of the discussion toward the end, and I don't think you're going to be able to stay for the full end. So I would encourage you to do that. Again, in the interest of time, I will move on to the next speaker. I also forgot to introduce, of course, Trish Wetzel, my co-chair, co-champion for this track, who is on travel and unable to be with us this time. So a lot of the preparation for this was due to her efforts as well. So if you go to the next speaker, it's Mike Kellen from Sage BioNetworks, and we're going to have genomics-oriented presentation now. So, Mike, if you want to test your voice, we'll let you go.
Hi, this is Mike Kellen with Sage BioNetworks. Can you all hear me okay?
We got you, yep.
Okay. So I'm going to give a presentation on some work that we're doing at Sage in collaboration with NCBO. And really, I'm coming to this conference from the point of view of an application developer. So I'm going to kind of give some of my perspective on where I see ontologies being useful and where we're struggling more with them. So first, slide one, some background on Sage itself. So I'm going to kind of give the use case at two different levels of granularity. So at the broadest level of granularity, what our mission is as a nonprofit research organization is to try to accelerate the process of discovery and the pace of research in the life sciences and particularly with respect to understanding human health issues. So specifically what we're trying to do is to create a open ecosystem around clinical data, particularly where that clinical data is connected to various types of molecular data. So it's very common right now. Clinical data usually gets generated during the course of a clinical study, and it is the organization conducting that study, whether it's a big pharmaceutical company or an academic research institute like a research hospital or something, and they're basically trying to determine one thing by running that study, and that is, does drug A work better than drug B, and if so, then we can go to the FDA and get approval and sell it, right? Our contention is that there's a lot of valuable information that's generated during the course of that study that is of broad research interest that doesn't necessarily answer that one specific yes-no question, but we feel that medical research itself would be accelerated if people were to be able to combine data from multiple studies, look across multiple studies, and ask questions other than that A-B yes-no question that the person running the clinical trial is interested in answering. So we need a system that helps bring that data together. And there's social and legal, you know, various issues on how do you do this that we get into that don't deal with software technology. There's issues around how do you do this from a data mining perspective that Sage addresses that I won't go into in this talk for the interest of time. I'm just going to talk about our technology platform for supporting this sort of research. So let's go to slide two. And this is basically just summing up what I said before. What we feel the community needs is open community-based analysis of this sort of information. Pulling in data from multiple sources, finding where the data is about the same sort of thing, being able to combine it, and then do sophisticated analysis to that data in order to answer additional questions other than the one posed by the initial clinical trials. Slide three is kind of a summary of the informatics project, which we call Synapse, and here's some high-level takeaways of what this platform is trying to do. We're trying to allow people to track in real time the analysis of these data sets, much the same way that GitHub allows software developers to track the evolution of software over a period of time. We're trying to, upper right-hand corner, we're trying to create mechanisms where people can initially share within consortiums or research groups and then eventually make data or analysis methodologies available for others for reuse. So there's this notion of projects and public and private spaces that you can mix into your own work. Lower left-hand corner, we're playing with issues around the social networking and how do you allow people to find new projects or find new talent for existing projects and bring them onto a project. And lower right-hand corner, the last thing is how do you leverage cloud computing, because some of these data sets are actually quite large and you need to be able to marshal sufficient computing power in order to do the actual analyses. So where ontologies really come in is data integration and making some of these large cross data set analyses possible. So let's go to slide four, and I'm going to talk one specific effort to basically curate and make large amounts of gene expression data available for reuse. So what happens right now is that people who do gene expression is basically a technology where you measure in mass the expression of pretty much all the 30,000 genes in a tissue on a set of samples and basically the situation now is that the people who generate that data typically as part of publishing a paper describing that one particular study, the journals basically force them to post that data for broad reuse in public repositories. And there's a number of different repositories out there. Geo, Array Express are some people just post them on their own FTP sites. There's other examples of public repositories. A very prominent one that we're working with now is TCGA, which is the Cancer Genome Atlas, and that's basically a broad-based consortium of people that are generating large amounts of clinical data and genomics information on tumors and the corresponding normal tissues. So basically, what we want to do is kind of create an index that goes across multiple data sources and say, well, okay, here's where the raw data is at, and here's some we try to standardize some of the terminology used to describe these data sets so you know tissue what Geo calls a study taken from liver is the same thing as Array Express calls a study from liver. So that's one sort of problem we have. And then once you kind of have this high level understanding of the data, then basically in the metagenomics process, there's some statistical normalization and processing of the data to make it available for use. So it's things like defining or identifying experimental artifacts, knocking out bad studies or bad portions of the studies, doing various sorts of statistical normalizations and transformations of the data to make it more generally useful. And then the idea is that we host that out for people to reuse, and then various downstream studies can pull in the raw data or our process normalized data and do their own comparative studies on it. So right now we have some 12,000 different clinical studies that are in some form have been normalized and integrated in our system. We've got some basically some algorithms that do error detection normalization. I think I kind of covered these bullet points already, so I won't belabor them. Let's go to slide 5. This is a little bit more detail about how some of these workflows get implemented. There's a case study up with Amazon, but we've basically been using a workflow system called Simple Workflow out of Amazon to do some of the large scale processing and organization of pipelines. So Amazon provides the kind of redundant bits of infrastructure for managing tasks, and then we write the specific tasks, which can be hosted either in the cloud or on our own infrastructure that actually do the work. Go next slide. So how do ontologies come in the system? So they basically come in a couple different ways. One is there's always some level of manual curation and need for manual cleanup of data that's loaded into the system via the automated pipelining. So we're building into the Synapse UI, very simple things that let users annotate data, but do it in a consistent fashion. So things like type ahead off a controlled vocabulary and, just very simple things like that. The automated data ingestion pipelines also talk to ontologies and get their sources of valid terms against, kind of a separately standardized ontology, and then, we map various external public data sets to the same ontologies internally. Ontologies drive faceted search within Synapse itself, and right now this is really focused on the kind of annotations of the data sets themselves, but we're going to have to drill into the next level of detail and actually do some of the same things on the actual clinical trial variables themselves. Which have a lot more variability to them. So let's go slide 7. From our point of view, the main benefits of ontologies are consistency of term use across many different data sets, which facilitates reuse of the data in novel ways. Users are able to find data that matches their own needs. So we have these studies that say, find me all data about prostate cancer because I have my own study in prostate cancer. I want to make sure that the signature of genes that are expressed during, that I'm seeing in my study is roughly consistent with what other people have seen in similar trials or if I'm seeing something really unique, I want to know that. So that's really the benefit is in data integration. The difficulties is that it's really the end users, not the software engineers, that are the domain experts, but they kind of can't articulate everything they need up front. So it's really hard to get the ontologies right up front. You kind of pull in bits and pieces of ontologies that other people have used, and you start trying to build that in the system and expose that to users, and then you get feedback whether or not that's allowing them to describe the data in a useful way. For that reason, we've really been driven to trying to expose very simple semantics to users, and that's where we see 90% of the value of ontologies is you can get with very simple semantics. And in particular, we've been really driven. Let's go to slide 8. We've been really driven to using SCO semantics as a way to provide very simple. A description of what an ontology is to end users in a way that they can understand and then tell us a synonym for the term X is Y, or term A is a narrower version of term B. And then, users can provide that sort of feedback. They can't map to very complicated upper ontologies. They get lost with OWL. So we kind of feel like there needs to be a very simple layer that allows users to effectively use ontologies and mark up content with them, and then if there are more sophisticated use of ontologies to make sure that there's widespread consistency, that kind of needs to be done behind the scenes by a dedicated software engineering team. So in general, my call out to the ontology community would be to focus less on the really esoteric high value, general purpose, you know, extensions to OWL and more on usability for a wider community of users. Because I see the real bottleneck is not that the technology is not powerful enough. The real bottleneck in the use of ontologies is that the domain ontologies are not good enough because it's too hard to engage the end users in iterative refinement of those ontologies. So I'll now open up for questions, or I'll flip over the chat maybe.
Thank you, Mike. I particularly find it interesting your final comments on avoiding the complexity of ontologies in favor of just trying to make them more usable. I think that's an interesting observation from the practical world that we all need to probably think about a little bit. Okay, so now we're moving into the domain of plant biology, and our next speaker is Damian Gessler. And again, we're actually keeping pretty well on time here, so I hope, Damian, you can hang in there and see if you can squeeze your slides into roughly 10 minutes. I'll let you go.
Sure. Hi, this is Damian Gessler. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, yes.
Excellent. I'm the semantic web architect at an NSF-funded project called the iPlant Collaborative. And at iPlant, what we're doing is building a national cyber infrastructure for the nation's plant scientists. We're doing this work with Blaz Bulka at Clark and Parja. He's not able to join us today, so I'll go through the slides. I have a number of slides. I'd actually like to present them kind of like a movie. So we'll be hitting a slide about every 20 seconds. The second slide, please. Yeah, yes. Slide on the field. Thanks very much. So we start this looking at plants. And when we start planting plants and we start our plant research, quickly the situation becomes complicated. Slide 3, please. And we start having to ask questions. For example, should we plant more sugarcane and take out more rainforest to address biofuel needs that may have a net benefit for the environment and for our society? Or should we preserve more rainforest and cut back the sugarcane or the maize or what have you? To answer these kind of questions, of course, we want to do it in an informed manner. Slide 4. We want to make these decisions on what to do and how to address research and production in complex systems, not based on if we live in a blue state or a red state. We want to base these decisions on evidence. In other words, we want an evidence-based decision-making infrastructure. Slide 5. There's just one problem with evidence-based decision-making is that, well, we need the evidence. And to answer these kind of questions in plant science, we need data that spans from evolutionary histories of the plants in question to biochemical, to physiological, up to the population and the community level. On slide 6, the iPlant Collaborative is looking at ways to build the necessary infrastructure so that scientists can begin to ask the appropriate questions and drive their science to answer them. On slide 7, though, as many of this on this telecon are aware, data integration is hard. That is, we see what we need to do. There's a lot of data out there, but it is recalcitrant integration, and it's recalcitrant for at least 3 reasons. It's recalcitrant for scientific reasons. That is, the scientific meaning and relevancy of the data often changes quicker than the lifespan of our informatic products. It's challenging because of technical reasons, different formats, things on different systems, and such. And data integration is challenging for social reasons. Different people in different countries, different institutions, different career goals. Different publication rates and such. And these 3 conspire to make data integration difficult for large systems like what we're trying to address in iPlant. Slide 8 shows how we're addressing this problem in a long-term scope. At the basis of foundational infrastructure, running high-performance computers, Ranger, for example, at TAC, the Texas Advanced Computer Center, running about 580 teraflops, they predict this will be up to about 10 petaflops in just a few years. And we need to bring this kind of high-performance computing to the desktop scientist. And we do this through a layered approach. On the left, we have enterprise-class assets like a discovery environment or atmosphere, which allows the spin-up of virtual images, that is kind of instant PCs, if you will, that you can access from your web browser. These interact with the web by traditional means. You open a browser and go to a discovery environment. But how do we interact with the assets on the web in a deep sense? How do we take the amass of data and information and services out there on the web and integrate them deeply to build a national infrastructure? And that's what we're going to focus on today, and that's the right box, semantic integration. Here's how we're going to do it. On slide 9, we're going to take a lesson from antibodies. And antibodies are a very neat little molecule in your body. At the bottom in the right, the part of the molecule has what's called a heavy chain. This is a conserved region. It's the same amongst antibodies in my body. It's the same between us. It's even the same between species. This is a constant molecular region that your body's macrophages can hook onto. And in the top part of the screen on the antibody is a very variable region. Not only is that variable part of the molecule variable between species and between individuals, it's even highly variable with inside any individual. In fact, you have thousands to millions of different types of antibodies. So the variable region in the antibody hooks into the particular antigen or germ or what have you that has invaded the body. And the constant region then allows a lock and key mechanism for the body's macrophages to lock on. Once you've locked on with this lock and key of an antibody, then the macrophages can literally engulf or eat up, if you will, the particular germ or bacteria, what we have you. We're going to use the same trick as a protocol in the semantic web. On the left part, we're going to have a protocol made with just a few classes and predicates, using AL, that has a very conserved region to it. That is, we will recognize in every case what's the resource, what's the subject data, and what does it map to? That is, what's the object data? Let's go down to slide 10. This is a picture of the protocol that basically shows how we use just a few AL classes in any document that lets us look at what is a particular service and what type of data does it take in and what type of data does it give out. And the particular types of data, the variable parts of the data, are up to the individual web resources that are out there. Let's go to slide 11. So here we have a web service provider. That is somebody offering a web service. And on slide 12, they represent the idiosyncrasies of their particular data according to the AL-DL protocol. Actually, a lot of developers don't know AL, or it's difficult for them. So we have an impedance mismatch layer. That is, we have a JSON layer that allows people to write up their data in JSON, and then we have an API that will automatically transform that into AL. On slide 13 is part of the key to the system, which shows that the way you mark up your data is by writing small ontologies, individual elements, if you will, not large ontology files, and hosting them on the web. So you describe your idiosyncratic data in terms that can be expressed in ontologies, host the ontologies, and then describe that in AL-DL according to the protocol. And 14 shows API, where it describes how you write the JSON, and then you just post the JSON to that same entry point, and it converts it to RDFXML. Once you've written your AL-DL on slide 15, you take that little description, it's a little document, it's maybe 20 or 30 lines long, and you publish it with us at our discovery server. On slide 16, we take the document that's been published to us, and we then reason over that. We disambiguate the graph, we validate it, we find all inferred truths, so we now have a little snapshot of a larger semantic web from the perspective of you as a semantic web service provider. Now on slide 17 are the other actors. There's a website provider out there, and there's you as a user or a scientist. And that website provider puts up a web page with some information on it. And on slide 18, you click a little button on that web page, and that activates a small snippet of JavaScript that we give the website providers that bundles up the data and then sends that data, usually just a simple JSON, to us at the iPlant Discovery server. When we get that, we map that JSON to Al, we reason over it, we match it. And on slide 19, we then present the user with a series of published semantic web services that we know about to allow them to choose where they want their data to go to. And on slide 20, it can stay on the website and drag and drop different semantic web services together and create, if you will, a pipeline from one website to another website to another website to another website. I'm going to wrap up the talk with just a few slides that then show how this works. So in slide 21, we have a mock-up page of a web page, and there's a little button in the middle that says swap.info. And the user clicks on this button. And at the next stage, they go to slide 22, and slide 22 shows them a semantic pipeline. Everything I'm going to show you from slide 22 on, in fact, everything I showed you before, except for that one mock-up page, is up and working and running at our beta site, swap.iplantcollaborative.org. This icon you now see on slide 22 that says TNRS is an icon of the user's data, all bundled up, and those services and only those services that can operate on that data show down below. The user can drag and drop those services and bring them in line. On slide 23 is a single slide on the core part of how we do data matching. We look for those services that match the type of service the user is looking for or a subclass of it, that can operate on the user's data or data that's more general, and that can return the type of data the user wants or data that's more specific. There's no sparkle that is exposed to the user. We deal with that on the back end. We do this type of matching simply and solely by looking at subsumption relationships in the protocol. Let's go to slide 24 and wrap things up and see what the user experience is like. As the user drags different service icons into the pipeline bar, the system automatically finds all those services that then can operate on the output of the upstream service. In 25, we see the user building longer and longer pipelines. Each time, the new services that are available at each step show up for the user to drag and drop in. On slide 26, you see how we can actually move the cursor in between on the pipeline, and as you move the cursor around, the system updates on demand, running a reasoner in real time at transaction time to figure out what services now satisfy that new request or what could take the data from the upstream service and send it to the downstream service. On slide 27, the user is trying to delete a service, and if you can do that, the system will allow you to do it. And on slide 28, the system does use a reasoner to look at that request, and if by deleting a service in the middle of your pipeline, you could no longer hook up the upstream to the downstream, it'll catch that and won't let you do that. On slide 29, we see how some services actually require parameters. Those parameters are expressed in the AL document. We read the AL document, and we generate a dialog page automatically by looking at that document and giving the user a way to add the various parameters that may be needed for the services. On slide 30, the pipeline is built, and the user presses the play button. And we then orchestrate the invocation of the data from the first website and sending it from one website to the next website to the next website. On slide 31, we show the user can pause a pipeline. You can't interrupt an individual web service because of the nature of services on the web, but we can stop web services as they go from one arrow or one icon to the next icon. And lastly, wrapping up, getting on slide 32, when you get to the end of the pipeline, you want to be able to view your data, so we have some capability as a generic viewer to allow the user to look at and to view arbitrary and generic AL graphs. On slide 33, we interact with the system in a tiered architecture, so the pipeline runs really separately from the UI. In fact, you can engage the pipeline simply by sending JSON back and forth. So in an enterprise class environment, you wanted a different UI or didn't want this drag and drop, you can still use the capabilities of subsumption matching with the pipeline by sending JSON on the back end. On slide 34, I just have one slide in here, a little bit about what are some of the ontological attributes that we're looking at here. That ontologies in this system are developed and maintained, and they evolve distributedly out on the World Wide Web. We relate properties and concepts logically, with no restriction that things need to be all in the same file or same similar physical location. There's no static ontology alignment per se. Essentially, every service is making an operational or a ephemeral relationship of how to take some type of input data to some type of output data. Querying and discovering is done by subsumption matching. I mean, you're reasoning at transaction time. On slide 35, I wrap things up with an architecture slide. This gives you a little bit of an overview about how all these components hook together, who the actors are, data and service providers, ontologies, clients, and how kind of a semantic Google, if you will, running on the back end. And with slide 36, I thank you very much for your time, and it was really a pleasure to show this to this group. Thank you.
That was very interesting. I think you raised a lot of interesting questions I imagine will show up on the chat with respect to things like service composition and stuff. So thank you very much, Damien. Please look at the chat, and I think that some questions will pop up. And stick around, we'll have an open, you know, dialogue at the end of this session. So our next speaker is Ilya Zaslavsky from the Supercomputer Center at UCSD. And now we're moving into hydrology of the application with lots and lots of data. So Ilya, are you hearable?
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Okay, that's good. Go ahead, please.
I will talk about a project called Quasi-Hydrologic Information System. Several quick slides at the beginning. Slide 2 is about Quasi. It's an association of universities funded by NSF. It's a small group in D.C. that tries to coordinate several projects. One of them is Hydrologic Information System. And the goal of that project is to try to organize hydrologic data, make them easier to publish, discover, and integrate. Next slide. That's a general outline of the system. It's a fairly small project, I would say, on the scale of computer infrastructure projects. It's about $1 million a year, and it funds several groups, mostly hydrologists, and us at the San Diego Supercomputer Center as the technology group. We work with several university partners, government groups, and commercial groups, and also are involved in several groups that develop standards. And in terms of architecture, at a very high level, it's a simple publish, find, bind pattern where we rely on standard services for exchanging hydrologic data. So the goal is to, slide 4, is to provide access to different types of hydrologic data. And they may come from different sources, and they would have different properties depending on what types of data mattered, whether it's groundwater or surface water, water quality, soil water. They will have different schemas and different properties. And also, slide 5, they are published by different sources. There, we have fairly large hydrologic data repositories maintained by U.S. federal agencies, such as USGS, National Water Information System, which is probably the most widely used hydrologic data repository. EPA has a system called STORAD, and now a set of web services that allows you to access to this system. But also, a lot of hydrologic data have been collected and published by state agencies, by university programs, and of course they all do it in their own ways, and there have been very different access patterns that we've seen for this type of data. Typically these are web forms which let you enter different sets of search parameters, then you get data bag that also comes in different schemas, sometimes as ASCII files, as HTML, sometimes as something else. And next slide, our first step was, of course, to try to establish some unification in to be able to grab different data in a consistent format and publish or republish them in a consistent format. So we developed an observations data model, information model that was eventually expressed as a relational schema, which is shown on this slide, and as an XML schema, which slide 7, which is called Water Markup Language. That schema has been actually quite successful because it was eventually adopted by USGS, National Water Information System, and a few other federal agencies, and there are about 80 services that are published in this schema. The service signature supports simple requests like get site information, get values, get variable information, and so on. So now we are trying to move that Water ML standard into becoming an international standard for exchanging data globally, and the standardization process goes through a group called Open Geospatial Consortium that works with WEML. These are a few intro slides just to give you an idea of what the project is about. Now I'm going to focus on one piece of this system called HydroCatalog, because this is where slide 9, because this is where we are accumulating metadata from different sources, and this is where we provide search that also takes into account semantics of variables. To give you an idea of what is the content of the catalog, we have 79 services, 16,000 variables, and remember this number, and 25 million time series that we manage from different sources. We average about 13,000 data downloads per day. So it's fairly reasonable for an academic system. WaterML, slide 12. WaterML helps us deal with structural heterogeneity of different sources. But semantics issues is what we have been struggling with. In fact, the project has not focused on semantics from the beginning. We are not experts in semantic technologies, but we figured quite quickly that we cannot move forward without without some semantic technology, simply because the number of variables is huge. The meaning that is attached to these variables is different across different sources. And if we want to just enable simple search, we face some interesting issues. I will show you some of these issues here. There are differences in how measurement units are handled. There are differences essentially in how every attribute of variables are handled. So different sources may have different names for units. They may certainly have different names for variable names. My favorite is shown in the corner here, this loft oxygen. Even the way we refer to variables, or different sources refer to variables, is different across sources. USGS calls them parameters, and they, since they've been developed historically, USGS, National Weather Information System, started measurements in 18th century, and these data are available in the system. The way of naming variables evolved over time, and it hasn't really changed, so they may have different ways of constructing variable names, sometimes with inclusion of units, methods, mediums, sometimes not, they may come in different combinations and so on. EPA refers to that property as characteristic, and they actually present as a characteristic just the root name of the variable, and other attributes can be found in other fields. National Climate Data Center calls this elements. There is climate and forecasting convention that is used in atmospheric sciences, where hydrologists get precipitation and other types of data to force models. Here there is a different naming convention, and we call them variables, but in reality they're many situations when people do not follow our controlled vocabulary for variables, typically using, yes, slide 14, thank you, sorry, typically using proxy variables like voltage, and what is the meaning of voltage would depend on where this measurement was taken and perhaps some other parameters that can be found in other files. Slide 15. Yeah, so we try to... sorry, misspelling in the first word. These are the types of conditions we are trying to work around in handling variable names. Variables can be... maybe similar but refer to quite different things. There may be multiple meanings and synonyms. What we developed is an I wouldn't really call it an ontology. It's a hierarchy because the child-parent relationships do not have consistent type of relationship between them, nor if this relationship is specified. But we found that using this type of hierarchy makes it much easier to do search. Next slide. So to support search, slide 17, to support search, we need to associate variable names with these concepts. And this is done differently for data supplied by university networks, where we have so-called Hydra server software that users can download from our website and install and publish hydrologic data. In for these networks, we harvest metadata, and then the set of variables that are used in that data set is presented to the user. The user can associate these variables with the concepts. So we keep the mappings, and this is how we can search them. For large repositories, we have tried to do that, these associations ourselves, slide 18, and we found a lot of interesting things, and this is an example of a collision between real data sets and vocabularies that have been created externally. So we get a metadata dump from National Water Information System, which shows variables that actually have data in this dump, and measure them against the substance register system, SRS, that just provides a list of concepts. And we figure that the match success is a little more than 20%. These 2,100 variables are those that are found in the catalog. They have associated data. They are also in the vocabulary, and hydrologists have been comfortable tagging these to the concepts in the controlled vocabulary, so that the hydrologist was sufficiently confident in doing the tagging. That was not true for actually majority of the variables. Right, slide 19. Once we have the mappings, we can do the search proceed via standard term expansion, and this is an example for nitrite nitrogen, where an entered concept is then expanded to variable names that exist in different data sets. And there are several methods that catalog search includes that contain this term expansion. We also, slide 20, we also quickly figured out that with this number of variables, we cannot manage semantics ourselves. So we try to develop tools for the community to do the management, and this is an online set of controlled vocabularies where users can go and suggest new terms. There is also a semantic wiki that allows you to annotate any of the concepts in the hierarchy, and also an editor that lets you change the hierarchy and adjust it to your search. These are deliberately simple tools because we had quite a lot of problems trying to convince hydrologists to work with tools like Prodigy and similar. Let's go to slide 21. Sorry. So this is some of the lessons learned. We found that for a very narrow and well-defined use case like search, we can quite easily demonstrate the benefits of using semantic technologies, but at the same time, we need to keep these semantic technologies very simple and manageable by community members so that they can be included in the development evolution of vocabularies. In this project, as I said, the focus has not been on moving semantic technologies forward, but trying to match the variety of meanings that hydrologists use in when they publish their observations to make it easier to search across that, and to support transition from knowledge that they have implicitly to some explicit encodings and to some form of community consensus. Unfortunately, there is no central organization to manage the consensus. Such a community consensus system, at least in hydrology, does not exist yet, and universities are not well equipped to manage it because we operate on project cycle. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you, Ilya. I think maybe that could help form that community consensus tools like this. So appreciate you giving us that perspective. And check the chat because people have been putting up questions there. So our last talk before we go into the open discussion is by Lynn Pouchard, and we're sort of staying in the earth sciences still as similar to hydrology. But taking a different angle here on a different problem to be solved. So, Lynn, are you is your microphone working? I don't hear you. Try pressing star 7.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Yep.
All right.
Okay, so take it away.
Hang on just a moment.
You're trying to get her updated set of slides.
Right.
With page numbers. I apologize. I totally forgot about that.
So if people would upload again, or download again, they might get the right deck.
So you have to refresh the page, right? The meeting page?
Do I have the right deck? I don't think so.
Doesn't seem to have page numbers on it.
No, not this either. Wonder why. Maybe Lynn just mention the slide title
it's
as much as you can.
Linked science? Yes. Okay. You mean instead of the page number? Okay.
Instead of page number.
Right. Okay. No problem. Yes, and it should not be a problem. So my talk is about linked science as a producer and consumer of big data in the earth sciences. I'm an information scientist from the scientific data group at Oak Ridge National Lab in the computer science and math division. My colleagues Bob Cook, Jim Green, Gary Palanisamy are from the environmental science division, and they are the domain experts who are working with earth and environmental sciences domain, mostly from the observation and experimental side. And Natasha Noy from Stanford University, who is one of the developers of the BioPortal, is well known to this community. So I'm moving on to the second slide, where so what is a linked science? And it's scientific collaborations are growing and becoming more and more interdisciplinary. And linked science is a practice that is accounting for these objects of study from an end-to-end perspective. And in the next slide, I'll explain more clearly what I mean from an end-to-end perspective. And there are key trends in the role of data in this for linked science. And In particular, there is a systematic emphasis on validated data sets, value-added data products, and traceable information and integrated processes so that the data that is being used in these scientific experiments and simulation is curated and sometimes by some organizational and different sponsors and archives. We had a first linked science workshop at the International Semantic Web Conference in last October, and I'm planning to have a second one this October, although the call has not come out. So I would encourage everybody to please submit to this. Next slide, please. So this slide would like to emphasizes what are the different aspects of linked science and how it touches and how it is it uses big data in and it's also a producer of big data. So in this particular case, we have both large data in terms of data sizes and also data in terms of very diverse variables and parameters. And the previous talk by Ilya very much also touched on these issues that at the same time we have large data sizes, but we also have a very different number of variables. So the little diagrams that you have on the left is like a scenario of for hydrology, Ilya was also in one of the early slides presenting a similar scenario where the top left side of pictures you have data which is coming from observational and experiments in the earth sciences. For instance, you have observational towers with instruments that measure concentrations of gases in the atmosphere. You have experiments in the warming up the soil at different levels of depth, for instance, in the boreal forest of northern Minnesota, and that's the two pictures that you have on the top. But you also have satellite pictures that are coming from NASA that give you maps of, for instance, forest biomass around the world. And all this data, which is observational and experimental data, is used for validating climate models. So climate models such as the ones that are being used for the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, there are some, as you know, like very large climate models for land, atmosphere, sea ice, and a couple of all these different models, and the next generation of climate model will include hydrology. So this is sort of like the scientific motivation for the kind of work that I have been developing. So what we have at RNL is this archive called one of the archives that we have for data sets called the RNL DAC, and which is a NASA sponsored archive for biogeochemical species such as nitrogen, carbon, phosphorus compounds such as those found in fertilizers, for instance, and there in this is observational data set, and we have about 1,000 data sets focused on biogeochemical dynamics, terrestrial ecology, environmental processes, and there's also almost 2 terabytes of data from the MODIS satellite, which is a picture that you see up there. And in the climate atmospheric science data, for instance, the modeling data that you could find in the Earth System Grid at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and that's only that particular node of or gateway of the Earth System Grid. At the last count, there was like 3,384 data sets, and the last count I made about a month ago, of computational data for about 1.3 petabytes, and there were 368 variables. So this gives you an idea of both the variety, the complexity of the data, and the sizes at the same time. So next slide, please. We're on the slide titled Mercury, Federated Metadata Engine for Earth Sciences Data. Slide number four, what you're looking at the right bottom right corner is the actual interface for the Mercury Federated Metadata Engine that brings in all the kind of data sources that you have outlined on the left. So the user would find the you know the system, the screen on the right, and then the data one instance of that catalog is one on the, above that, and so the system harvests the metadata from all the different data sources that are on the left, and some of them are maybe familiar to you, like NBII. There's like different two NASA DAC archives, the RNL DAC and the LP DAC. There is a LTR, and there are also some of these USGS, for instance, is also providing data there, and it's providing it in all kind of different formats and different metadata standards, which you see like BDP, EML, EML, and a number of these other schemas. And what the Mercury does is that the index is compiled and then is stored in a Apache Solar Engine at the internal metadata index and presented to the user in a faceted search, which they can also do geolocation searches. And all the metadata is represented in metadata in XML metadata documents, and Mercury holds about 100,000 metadata records from several different providers and with new different type of search capabilities. So all this work existed before the and not only existed but had been well accepted by users, and it also had been well recommended, and the sponsor was NASA originally, was happy to fund the system, and so there was, in particular, they were very happy with a traditional faceted search, which we'll see an example further down. But so there was never a question of changing the interface completely or changing the system or designing the system from scratch in order to be able to implement a semantic search, even though they were interested in semantic searches. So next slide, please. We're on slide five, which is titled "The Coupling the Mercury Federated Metadata Engine and BioPortal." So what I did there is that instead of redesigning the system at the level where you could actually bring in all these ontological annotations from the start, I decided to use an ontology service to bring in ontology annotation to the existing metadata search capability as a first step towards showing the value of semantic searches. So in this slide, what you have in green is the existing architectural the existing architecture of the Mercury metadata engine, and the ontology service is the orange box that we added. So we have been able to, with very little manpower, add these semantic ontology annotations to the search engine by using the programmatic access, the REST services from BioPortal. So next slide, please, which is slide six, and you will certainly recognize, and for those of you who have worked with BioPortal, you will be able to recognize the interface. We haven't changed any of that. So what we have done is that we have implemented our own ontologies, that we have brought in ontologies that our users were interested in using for this particular domain and the users of this archive. And so in order to be able to show them, you know, what you know, kind of ontology terms, and in particular, to be able to show them what exists within the semantic web for Earth and environmental terminology, the suite ontologies that we have brought in here. So next slide, please. I'm on slide 7, and this is a search. This is a screen titled "Ontology-Based Search Results." So this is the interface that you will get from the Mercury search engine. So if you look at the first the 5 tabs that you have on the top, as well as all the metadata summary and the different data sources that are outlined there, the type of query that we get, this is what was originally and is still being used in Mercury as a faceted search. What we implemented with the link to BioPortal were the 4 boxes at the bottom with the red lettering in it. And this is where we can see we bring the user to the ontology concepts and how we show them what is being found, and particular in the ontologies that we have in BioPortal. So the advantage of some of this work is that we were able to show for a user who is a scientist who is using some type of concepts and is looking for certain data sets, like let's say here we'd have 1,227 documents in that part, that this search on biomass, where they would be able to find that the ontology, through the ontology concept, that and the superclass that biomass has, you know, there are 2 types of biomass. You can look at biomass as a material, or you can look at it as an energy. And depending on the scientific study that you're doing, you're going to be interested in different kind of data sets associated with biomass. So the superclass also give, of course, different type of properties to the ontology. And what was also interesting to us was the ontology subclasses, because this provided us with additional search terms that were not in the original faceted search, since the faceted search only restricts the number of the sets that you have, and only highlights aspects of that the search results without adding any new terms in there. So in particular, we found the some data sets that had that were annotated only with the keyword humus, and they were not annotated under biomass, and the Mercury search engine did not highlight these data sets. So that's something that they were particularly interested in showing, that the ontology could bring in additional data sets, additional search terms. The next slide, which is slide 8, was a metrics assessing the impact of using ontologies in search. At the development level, this was a very small amount of additional development because I was interested in getting a legacy system without making too many changes to it, so, and still show some benefit that the ontologies could bring us.
We're a little short on time, Lynn, if you could wrap it up.
Okay. So this are the top 100 Mercury parameters, which are the variables, and it shows the frequency count of the matches between those and the terms in the ontology, in particular in suites. And the main result here is that 79% of the top 100 keywords have at least one match in the ontologies that we had, and we had terms like water that had 38 matches, or air and carbon, 28. My last slides, lesson learned. So the ontology content, the scientific content, is where we would need to make the most improvement, especially to customize it and specify some of the terminology to match the users of this particular archive. And another important lessons is also how we're going to modify the display of the faceted search so that the users will still be able to get some benefit without using the speed that they had gotten with the solar search engine. Okay, and on the last slide, we have all the URLs for those who want to look into this a little further and see this in action. And I would like to thank you for this attention.
Okay, thanks a lot, Lynn, and thank everyone, for all the speakers, for cramming, speeding up their talks so that we had a little bit of time for discussion. So we still have about a half an hour for now live discussion.
Wonderful.
We've had a lot of people putting in some great comments on the chat and some great responses to those comments. But what I'd like to invite people to do now is, if you click the little raise your hand button on the lower right of the chat board, then we have a chance now for some people to actually orally ask some questions and get some dialogue on the audio here, which might be faster for some of these issues. So you're all invited to go ahead and raise your hand, and then you'll have to unmute your phone with a *7, and I'll call upon you as your name comes up on the list.
Steve, I have no access to chat. I'm Ravi Sharma.
Hi, Ravi. Okay, next, and why don't you go ahead? There's no list yet, no queue yet, so you can go ahead.
Okay, so for line is speaking, right? Line was speaking last, right?
Yes.
So for line, I have a question. The work that you showed integrated a lot of metadata sources from multiple DACs. I noticed the NASA DACs, and also I noticed that you had other bio dependent sources. My question is that the NASA multiple data active archives that we are accessing have FGDC standard for metadata, while the other sources have other interfaces. That's one comment. The other comment is, how do you extract terms, and in what way would those terms be different if you just did a hierarchical decomposition? And second question is that we used to have some worldwide science org would automatically search for relevant terms. Have you compared the DOE application in worldwidescience.org, which would compare the results of these two findings? So one, contrast with hierarchical search. Second, I mean, when I say hierarchy, I mean taxonomy type. And second, kindly, if you can give some comparative inputs on the worldwidescience.org findings.
Okay, I think I can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so what you're asking about is the different type of data inputs that are being brought into the Mercury federated search engine. That would be on slide 4 that I had. So the Mercury inputs data, that is, the DACs are, of course, using FGDC like you suggest, but that is being done at the metadata ingest before this is being brought into the internal metadata index of Mercury, which is on the which is a solar search engine. So this index is being compiled. So all these metadata terms and all these metadata schemas are being brought in at ingest within the Mercury Apache Solar Index engine. Okay. Now, this is not something I had access to or something I was able to I could work with. This is a that's why I was saying this system was existing and functioning for users who were already very happy with that. This is why I chose to look at and all this is already a taxonomy. And based on this taxonomy, they were using a faceted search. So what I was able to do is by bringing ontologies, domain science ontologies in BioPortal and querying programmatically through the REST services from the Solar engine, I was able to add additional metadata terms, which in turn could bring new data sets. So in the query expansion, this is, the faceted search will only look at, find the data set and highlight certain aspects of it that already exist within your set of results. Whereas here I was able to bring additional results. Okay. And that worked really well in terms of improving the recall. So for the use case that we had in the RNL DAC for biomass, originally, there were 187 data sets with biomass, and there was 5 with humus that had not been returned by the original search on the parameters, the taxonomic search, because humus was not shown anywhere. It was, humus is a type of biomass, which is what the ontology brought in. Now, your second question, I don't have any answer to that because I didn't look at this particular taxonomy.
It's part of ORNL OSTI, OSTI, Office of Science and Technology Information.
Okay.
And it's part of DOE if you are using any of their resources.
Well, she needs to be, so there you go.
It's a very large organization. And it's
I know. Please look at that because it would be nice to know whether term-based searches like they do in deep data archives, which are also very large, spread over 60 countries, and how do they compare with this kind of approach would be very valuable from ontology perspective.
Okay.
That's all. I thought you might be familiar, so I assumed that. Thank you. It's very valuable what you found, especially the frequency coverage of terms, keywords. Keywords are not exactly terms yet, but combination of them are. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Robbie and Lynn. I don't see any hands up on the queue, but I would put a concept out there for discussion, which is what I'm perceiving in all of these talks is that most of these applications are not trying to delve deeply into the precise pragmatics of the ontology, but rather emphasizing the usability of these relationships, often just stopping with some OWL statements and not trying to make it all very precise. And I'm just curious to see what any of the panelists think about that or the audience. Certainly, some of the speakers were saying that maybe we don't want to go overboard on precision in favor of just having a usable system which will give you partial advantages in terms of reasoning. Does anyone have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. It's a very pragmatic approach, and from my point of view, I've been just to be able to get buy-in from the user community, buying from the funders, buying from the other software developers to just allow to show them a little bit of, what can be done with this goes much longer way than actually discussing, what matters in terms of the ontology development. Now, this being said, of course, since it's extremely important to have you know, solid reasoning ontologies in order to be able to move this work. I have been trying to use not only, you know, ontologies like SWEET, which is very solid in that respect. And if I get a chance to develop a few more, I'm actually, Data One is having a summer internship program, and I have a, you know, a project in there for a student that I would like to develop some specification of the soil science and get more additional ontological concepts, extend SWEET for soil science in order to be able to make progress in this work.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting. In fact, that raises a further question, but I'll just put the question out there, which is I'm wondering if people are finding there are some core ontologies that are out there which are particularly useful for building applications. But while people are thinking about that, Simon Sparrow has his hands up, so I'll let Simon go ahead and chime in. Don't forget to press star 7.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to note something, and I think there's a question in there somewhere. One of the themes that seem to show up a lot, especially in the latter few of the presentations, is that what seemed to be being created and being used, controlled vocabulary is in the information science sense, where what they're doing is giving essentially terminologies in search, basically designed for search, with semantics intended for search, and there seems to be not that much of what I would typically refer to as an ontology, in contrast to that, where you're actually talking about what there is rather than what things are about. And I was wondering if that was a deliberate need-based choice for the applications, or if it was a result of the difficulty in understanding the ontologies that are in technical languages like OWL, and so it was would be a tooling issue. Okay, and I'll make that the question.
Mm-hmm. And I invite any of the panelists to chime in on that.
No? I think this is actually a very good observation. And indeed, we had problems of both kinds. One is that our use case is fairly narrowly defined, and we just need to do search. And we are not doing reasoning, so we may not need the power of description logic and all. The second is that, and that may be just the case of our group of hydrologists who were part of the project, they really wanted to look at XML and how it is represented on the back end, and they did look at all, and they did try to work with Prodigy, and that didn't work very well. So I would say that both issues are in place.
And are you saying it didn't work well because of usability, or why didn't it work well with Prodigy, for example?
I would say the mental model that hydrologists have of the concepts that they work with probably did not quite map well to what Prodigy requires you to enter for every relationship and concept.
Huh.
It would take some additional analysis to actually state this precise, but we had several people try it, and I'm not sure if it's usability of the software or just they've been trying to do things that seem to be simpler for them and not to get bogged down by additional relationships that they may not need in their work.
Okay, interesting, because it raises the question is whether or not the meta model that Protégé puts out there, and indeed the ontologies, are properly mirroring the way people think. But let me ask. Go ahead.
I would say it's the question of user interface, because the model is consistent and nice, but probably hiding that complexity for different communities would make sense.
Okay. Michael Gruninger, you have your hand out. You want to test your voice?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So I guess one way of kind of combining some of the ideas that David was saying about testing the ontologies and also say the kind of the amount of reasoning that needs to be supported by the ontologies to look at the problems from the point of view of competency questions. So the kinds of queries that you are designing your ontology to support in the context of your particular application. And it might be kind of interesting if, I guess, offline, the panelists today could have a really short set of what these competency questions would be in their applications. Because, again, that can be used to not only evaluate the ontologies that they're using, but also to determine, how many axioms do you need to actually solve these questions. And if these questions don't require a sophisticated set of axioms, then you're okay. But if they really do, then, you have to kind of really consider exactly whether or not you're achieving what you want to achieve with the ontology that you're using.
Reactions, anyone? It seems to make sense to me. I'll let people think about that one while I pass the baton over to Peter.
Thank you. I noticed suite was mentioned in various presentations, and it is with sadness that I made a post earlier to Ontolog Forum. Maybe some of the people in the summit community weren't on that list. Sadly, we lost the principal investigator, Dr. Robert Raskin, less than a week ago. He passed away last Friday. And of course, his work in the semantic web for Earth and environmental terminology, acronym SWEET project, and the SWEET ontology will be with us. And to his memory, I want to just let everyone know that it has been a great loss to the field and particularly to our community, because Rob has been very actively contributing from the ontology for knowledge management and decisions support mini-series to the open ontology repository efforts, to the ontology summit, and as well as to the units of measure ontology efforts.
Indeed. Thank you, Peter, for bringing that up. Indeed, that was quite a sad news.
And on a separate note, I have one speculation to an earlier remark from Ilya. Partly, I mean, from the real life domain expert's perspective, maybe trying to squeeze things into, let's say, description logic could have sort of posed some of the constraints. So I would think maybe expressivity comes into the picture as well. When we try to really express ourselves and put together the semantics, some of the tools or languages may not be providing us the expressivity or the access to allow us to properly do so. I mean, that's one speculation too.
Could be, although I found as a mere mortal that sometimes just being forced to think very pedantically and rigorously with even the very expressive, and perhaps mostly with the most expressive languages, is difficult for people to really think about how they think. And that is going to be sort of a barrier, I think, regardless of which technology we bring to bear.
Yeah, so, my point is, I mean, at least the flexibility of a real domain expert to express, I mean, try to express what it is. I mean, let's say, for example, multiple inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, real life things just this play multiple inheritance. I mean, when people says you can't do it or you have to do it, but you have to reify, that doesn't cut it for the domain experts. I mean,
sure.
They are not ontologists.
That's true. That's true. Okay, Todd, do you have a comment or question?
Yes, I'll press on with what Peter was saying, and some of the other speakers addressed it, and other participants addressed it. The interaction of perhaps your application user with an underlying ontology is a continuing problem. Now, there's several aspects to that that could be talked about. Peter brought up one having to do the expressivity of the language. The other had to do with the interface to that expression capability. But then there's another aspect that was only briefly mentioned, and it might have been you, Stephen, that people's mental models many times do not correspond to what is needed for, if you like, first-order logic reasoning or even higher-order logic reasoning in terms of the strictness and explicitness that has to be made. People have the ability to unconsciously do reasoning in various modes, but once they have to try and make it explicit, in particular the domain knowledge over which they are wanting to reason, making that explicit is very painful, and most domain users have that implicitly, or they are trained to have that knowledge implicitly, and to make it explicit is very tedious.
Yeah, that was exactly my point, I think.
But we need to facilitate that in some regard. I would prefer to have a well-developed ontology if you have the time, and then provide some mediating interface, which I believe was suggested in at least one of the talks, to map to the domain terminology.
Right. The proxy ontologies, is that what you're talking about?
Well, something along those lines, but a little better, because I believe what was mentioned in terms of David talked about it, proxy ontologies, was just a way to interface with the XSD stuff. But, of course, you could extrapolate that to a general user interface, because sort of the terms that are used in XSDs are closer to colloquial usages in particular domains.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be a pattern there, and it, you know, this interaction, this mediation capability should be part of any architecture that's going to be using semantic technologies based on good ontologies.
And Todd, wouldn't you think perhaps some of the controlled English, you know, systems out there might be a way also to help, where they have some implicit implications humming along in the background?
Well, you could use those as part of the mediation layer, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Again, those are closer to colloquial usages and colloquial understandings.
Exactly.
And, of course, you could probably put up warning messages, too, when people are going off course there, as was, I think, was suggested in one of the presentations.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, I guess this might be Dennis Wisnowski. I'm not sure. As DWiz 3, you'll have to press.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, the way that our Enterprise Information Web project works, the one that I started to talk about last week, hopefully you'll see live in April, is exactly like whoever was just speaking works. There's a mapping ontology between the domain ontologies and the upper level ontology that we have in the business enterprise architecture. So we don't try to have a perfect ontology at the upper level. I agree with whoever said that's impossible. We don't try to get the domains to change what they're thinking. We just get ourselves to understand what they're thinking. That's the most efficient way to approach this, we believe.
Okay, yep. Thank you. And I noticed you're on there four times, but that'll keep our membership numbers up here. Does anyone else have any really last comments? We're approaching 6 minutes away from the end of this session. So I'll invite anyone to ask a question, make an observation. I'll pause here for a moment. And failing that, I think I really appreciate the presenters, because I think we got a great spectrum of perspectives here of domains and indeed challenges that the different systems were trying to overcome. So no sense running out the clock for 5 minutes unless anyone else has anything to say, or perhaps, Peter, you have any logistics comments for next week's meeting. The other logistics issue is, again, I think Peter was reminding me to just remind you all that our face-to-face meeting is just over a month out, so if you wanted to start taking advantage of cheaper flights or something, you might want to look into those flights to D.C. now before they run them up. So in the absence of Ian, Peter chiming in, I'd say we're about done with this week's session. And again, on behalf of Trish Wetzel and myself, I'd like to thank the speakers. Thank you all for coming. And we will reconvene again in a week. Okay, I will close this meeting. Goodbye, all.
Great. Great session. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.